Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so pleased to welcome back for the first time in 2017, Dr. Art Sear, a faculty colleague of mine, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War. Professor Sear joins us once a month to offer his analysis and perspective on important events and issues both here and around the world. And Professor Sear, welcome back and Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year to you, Greg, and thank you for inviting me back. Before we get carried away, as usual, too far into the program, I want to underscore the importance of an event that took place last Friday. Many of your listeners are already aware of it. There was an important inauguration, an important investiture of Wynne Laufenberg as circuit court judge in Racine County. She is a longtime law partner, along with being an accomplished attorney in her own right. She's a longtime law partner of Mike Fegley, another attorney from Racine who teaches at Carthage. And they worked together over a long period of time to create and carry forward to great success our mock trial program, which reached nationals last year. Mike is an extraordinary leader, and she is as well, and we're all better off that she will be in court along with other fine judges, including her predecessor in Racine. The older I get, the more I appreciate the importance of the rule of law in our country and others. And this was just great news, and I was very glad to be able to attend that, especially last Friday.
So there was more than one inauguration that took place on Friday.
Yeah.
I probably because of that and other reasons, you've told me that you weren't able to watch Friday's inauguration of President Donald Trump, but watched his speech later on, looked at the text, and so on. I wonder, first of all, if you just had any general reactions to the day, to the event, to the way things played out, and particularly, of course, what President Trump had to say on this really important occasion.
It was a distinct, as understandably so much media commentary has emphasized, it was a very distinctive kind of inaugural address. It wasn't really a speech. It wasn't really rhetoric in the traditional sense. He underscored with emphasis. It was a very brief speech, and he basically spoke briefly using the kind of talking point, bullet point style that he's made famous and that he's carried to great success. I was surprised, but I tell you, I've been consistently surprised by events over the last year and a half. I don't want all our listeners to turn off their radios immediately or their other streaming devices, but it's been a great humbling education for me to see how events have unfolded in our great country.
One of the things that was striking to me was what he had to say. I mean, really pretty much blistering criticism of the Washington establishment and Congress really in particular in this particular setting. I think some people thought on this kind of occasion with dozens of those very congressmen right there on the stand with him, that he would not necessarily express himself as vehemently as he did. And I suspect for those that really support him and voted him into office, a lot of them probably appreciated that frankness. And for others who are not so supportive of him, were probably kind of shocked that he would level that kind of critical commentary in that setting with all of those people actually a few feet away from him.
You're absolutely right. Clearly, he was speaking to his committed constituents, and millions of our fellow Americans are very much committed to him. and his approach to things and his style of leadership so far, and he was very much addressing them. He was talking to the base, as the political and campaign pros say. You're quite right about that, Greg. Hmm.
What about the matter that has sort of exploded of how many were in attendance? And, of course, I'm sure all of our listeners are aware of this controversy, namely that that the observation was made that these numbers were nothing like the number of people who attended President Obama's first inauguration, which my understanding is was an unprecedented crowd anyway. I mean, there were so many things that made that a very different election and moment in our history. And so, I mean, nobody had seen anything quite like that before in terms of a crowd at an inauguration. And there's no shame in not reaching those numbers, those who come after that. But clearly it bothered President Trump quite a great deal, and his press secretary had blistering criticism for the media, who he felt had mischaracterized the size of the crowds and so on. What do you make of that whole brouhaha, and what do you think it says about what is ahead in terms of this new administration and their relationship, first of all, with the press?
Appearances are always important, and one sign of getting old is you tend to idealize the past. We live in a very superficial time, however, undeniably. We're talking only about appearances. I believe there is a very profitable, for both sides, unholy alliance between our new president and much of the media, including public radio and television. They feed off his statements. It's a way of raising ratings and making money. He very shrewdly appreciated this early on, and didn't have to spend a lot of big money in contemporary terms on his primary or general election campaign because he got all this frenzied media attention. And in many ways, I think the most hostile media personalities, many of them are hardly reporters in a professional sense, are most guilty of feeding off this. That's one point to make. Secondly, a lot of people watch television, as I think Trump's press secretary, President Trump's press secretary, in one of his calmer moments pointed out, a lot of people don't have to be there to be there. And I'm sure he had a very, very substantial television and other media audience.
Right.
Important point. The other point to make is when you're the president of the United States, you don't have to constantly pick fights. You don't have to constantly engage in battles. You don't have to constantly respond to every goddamn, negative or hostile or critical or what you consider irritating. I think a real test of any president, including this one, is whether you can't really be president unless you rise above all this. You have the opportunity to do that, for goodness sakes, more politely. And I'm waiting with anticipation for our new leader to do that.
Right. I mean, in my mind, the big story became, the bigger story became not how many people came to President Trump's inauguration. That story was dwarfed by his press secretary trying to convince the world that, no, in fact, despite the photographic evidence to the contrary and the evidence of the turnstiles and the public transit system in Washington, D.C. to the contrary, that this was the largest crowd in history. I mean, the fact that of trying to fly in the face of all of the evidence, that became a bigger story than the first story about how many people were actually there.
Kellyanne Conway, the principal point person in the Trump campaign after a career in the trenches working for Ted Cruz, which I'm sure was great experience. This is why she refers to alternative facts. I know this is important. I would suggest we move on, Greg. I think you and I are being guilty of what I've been just complaining about. This is not the most important issue facing us. I think we've covered it pretty well.
Well, I agree.
Thank
the,
you.
I agree and I disagree. I agree in that the size of the crowd in Washington on Friday is not a particularly important matter. But the president's style in terms of how he deals with what are pretty much undisputable facts and the way he uses his press secretary and the way they deal with the media and the whole matter of establishing trust, you know, one of the most important things a president needs to do right out of the starting gate. Those are important matters.
Good point. Yes, trust is an important, abstract, hard to define, but crucial dimension for any leader. Any leader.
Let's move on to his. Let's move on to his nominees, which we talked about some the last time you were on the morning show. And I appreciated the perspective that you had, because I know that many people not in support of now President Trump, then President-elect Trump, wringing their hands at the fact that there are all these millionaires and maybe a couple of billionaires in this crowd. And it felt to some like something quite unprecedented. And you, I think, rightly pointed out that, in fact, it isn't all that unprecedented for folks from this kind of level of the business world and so on, being tagged for some of these important positions. So you don't see any particular reason for concern, at least along those lines.
I think it reflects the fact, well, sure, I've got my own concerns, at least about some of the individuals he's picked and about the president himself. However, you get at an important point. I refer to the Eisenhower administration, and the quip back in the 50s was the New Dealers, FDR and Company, and Truman are being replaced by the big dealers. He picked a lot of Fortune 500 CEOs for major slots, and it was a very, very effective cabinet in hindsight. Eisenhower was careful, however, and this gets at your important point, not to be photographed or seen socially. He also liked the company of big businessmen. He was a very, very skillful executive, unlike the vast mass of politicians, and was very comfortable with people who were effective at running large organizations. But he was very careful not to be seen in public very often with them, and for a very good reason. From the New Deal until fairly recently, certainly into the 1980s, there was a very strong popular current of hostility to business. Walter Wriston was a contemporary of Tom Clawson's. They became friends. Wriston ran and built Citicorp at the same time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that Tom Clawson was leading Bank of America twice. Unlike Tom, Mr. Wriston was from a very privileged background, and in trying to do research on Tom Clawson before I went out to meet him after he came to work here, I ran across a statement from Wriston. He said, you know, when I got out of the Navy after World War II, we didn't publicize the fact that we were involved in finance. Now, he was from a very privileged family and a very distinguished one, including diplomats and others, not just business executives. But he was very conscious of this hostility to business that is not part of the long sweep of our history most of the time. We've always had strong populism. But hostility to business as an institution, especially bankers, clearly faded in the 1980s. John Riley, the long time, 30 years, successful president of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, where I worked for 20 years, was very effective at fundraising, among other things. And thanks to his background working for Hubert Humphrey in Washington, and on the road, knew about raising money the honest way and was very skillful in dealing with big business leaders. I'd never dealt with him till I took this job in Chicago. We had chairman under that management, which was independent. We would have a chairman rotating for three years, usually. One leader, a very impressive fellow from a major Fortune 500 corporation, who was good enough to be our chairman for a few years. In the 1980s, I was chatting with his wife, who was a kind of traditional corporate wife of that era, in my view, and she said, you know, you don't have many real business leaders on your speaker's platform. You have a lot of professors and journalists. And I pointed out to her, politely, I thought, that it's harder to line up executives, and often big business, especially CEOs, when you get them, they don't actually say anything. At least professors and reporters speak their minds. And she looked a bit miffed. And later on when I encountered him, it was clear that he was miffed too. It wasn't just my paranoia. But it reflected the kind of gun-shy nature, to me, of that earlier generation of corporate leaders. That has faded quite dramatically. I think the Reagan administration was probably a turning point, and we're back kind of to business as usual in the U.S.
with a little more openness and flamboyance.
It's an extremely important point. Well, more confidence.
Right.
More security, if you will, in being at the top. If you really want to read scary speeches, read FDR's campaign speeches, not from 32 when he was playing it safe because everybody knew President Hoover was finished. In 36, it's scary stuff. You know, he really beats the drum about class warfare. We had not recovered from the Depression. Important major reforms had been put in place, but the economy really didn't start to kick in again until 1940. And you could sense the popular resentment and hostility of the rich and the corporate establishment in America, which FDR exploited.
Right. Well, and of course,
it's a very important point concerning the sociology of our great country.
Oh, absolutely. And it kind of depends on who you are and where you are in terms of this deepening divide we have now of a smaller and smaller ultra rich at the very top getting richer and richer and so on, and yet
quite right, very important,
right. And so it'll be interesting to see where we're going. Of course, at this moment in time, however, we elected a president who's, I don't know, is he the wealthiest president we've ever had in terms of his own personal wealth?
Well, we don't know, because he has not released his tax returns, and I think there are probably some very good reasons for that. I'm sure it's obvious he has readily available cash, and he does have gross assets, but it's a very interesting question how wealthy this individual is, and the short answer is no. In real terms, the founders, not Hamilton, but certainly Ben Franklin and others, were well off, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and the Adamses. Franklin Roosevelt was from a family of vast wealth, as was John F. Kennedy. Right. So even if the reality is, even if I'm another cynical, suspicious old professor, the current president, I'm pretty sure, is not the wealthiest who's ever occupied the White House.
Let's shift away from nominees for just a moment, since we're talking for a moment about President Trump's significant wealth. As I'm sure you followed, and I know our listeners probably heard on Morning Edition just today, a watchdog group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, who are advised by two primary legal advisors for President Obama and President George W. Bush,
yes,
Norman Eisen and Richard Painter, have essentially filed suit suggesting that President Trump is in violation of the Constitution by not divesting himself of his assets. And the way it was phrased by somebody with that organization this morning was, in turning over control of his enterprises to his sons, said it's a little bit like just handing over your wallet to your son, but it's still your wallet, and it's still
you
your
don't want to do that.
But it's still your wallet, and it's still your money. So, I mean, in their mind at least, the president has not done what he needs to do in order to be in full compliance with our laws. What's your understanding of those laws? I mean, what is the potential conflict of interest that we are talking about versus the sort of the legal matter, which is probably too murky for either of us to sort out? But what kind of an impasse are we talking about here?
I don't know. It'll play out in the courts, and I sure am glad we referred to the rule of law and Judge Laufenberg at the very beginning of the program. I believe the specific challenge you refer to refers to the Constitution and prohibition of receiving foreign emoluments, a direct reflection of our revolutionary heritage and the fact that the British not only had the most powerful navy and the toughest army, in my view, in the world, but and also shrewd and skillful and ruthless diplomats and politicians and the rule of law, but they're also quite skillful at using bribes, which is part of international relations, and I think it was a reference to that back then. So it's on basic constitutional grounds. Since the 60s, since all the tumult and dissolution of the Vietnam era and then Watergate, there are strict ethics rules that have been put in place and are very complicated, increasingly so. I believe the first President Bush gave very, very high priority to that. So we live in a time when you have to fill out very, very detailed financial forms, and apparently given the extensive holdings of some of President Trump's nominees, as we've mentioned, some of them are still, their staffs are working on the paperwork. It's very, very detailed and very demanding. Very durable leader in Chicago is Mike Moscow, who was a senior and successful corporate executive at several companies, including Dart Kraft. He was a supportive board member of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He's got a PhD in economics, and he's a very fine gentleman, and was head of the Chicago Fed. I'm very proud that we got him to visit Carthage a few years ago in that capacity. He acquitted himself very well in the classroom and with the professional leadership here. When he was deputy trade representative in the G.H.W. Bush administration, he was nice enough to see me for dinner in Washington. A big part of my job involved keeping in touch with contacts and developing new ones for our council in Chicago. I had to wait till quite late in the evening because he was getting ready for a major trade mission to Japan. We were doing battle over auto parts at that point, around 1991. We went to a modest bistro, and at the end of dinner, we had to sit and carefully divide the bill, which was under $30 for both of us, because if I paid for him, I could go to jail, and if he paid for me, he could lose his job, or maybe it was the other way around. But wow. It's funny, but it's not. You know, this guy was under tremendous pressure, and this sort of penny-ante stuff, I think, symbolizes how in politics, appearance becomes much more important than reality. But in point of fact, ethical standards, compared to the 60s, for instance, and before, ethical standards are vastly higher. And it's all to the good. Hmm. And I'm sure there's going to be lawyers are going to be, a lot of lawyers are going to be fully occupied, and judges too, during the Trump administration. I'm pretty confident in that prediction.
Right. For those of you just joining us, my guest on today's morning show is Dr. Art Sear, one of our most frequent guests to the morning show. He visits us once a month to offer his analysis and perspective on various events and issues. He is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business. Among the nominees is retired Marine Corps General James Mattis.
Yes.
And you wrote quite an interesting column about him and the fact that it took a special waiver to be voted on the Senate overwhelmingly, 81-17, because not sufficient time had passed between his retirement from the military and him assuming his new position, and you applauded that because you very much appreciate many things about General Mattis, and he reminds you of another distinguished general from our more distant past, General George C. Marshall. Tell us about your admiration for General Mattis and why you think he would be a valuable addition to the Trump administration.
Well, first, I mentioned Marshall because of the importance of his example and the importance of that history. He was chief of staff of the Army before and during World War II, and just was a crucial leader. Important to talk about him any time, including our time. A crucial leader in getting us as ready as we were. We were woefully unprepared when Pearl Harbor was struck, but we would have been in vastly worse shape had he not almost single-handedly worked hand in glove with President Roosevelt in rebuilding our Army and, to some extent, other military arms. He was, in effect, the principal military commander during World War II. He served as Secretary of State as well as Secretary of Defense after the war in the Truman administration. Both FDR and Truman valued him to an extraordinary degree for good reasons. He needed a special waiver.
Oh, yeah, he was the last one who's had such a waiver, I think.
Which was an opening to bring him up. I believe that with the end of conscription, now back in the 1970s, as well as the end of the Cold War. We have a situation where the military is increasingly segregated from the rest of society. And in contemporary terms, Mattis, I think, is clearly a man who understands war. He's very much dedicated to his country as well as the military, despite the best efforts of Democrats and the media. There have been no serious ethics charges brought against him, and I think we should all hope for the best. But that's a major challenge for any democracy. I show our students in some of my classes Eisenhower's farewell address, which was largely ignored in early 61 when the president made the speech from the Oval Office. It's resonated more and more since that time because he quite brilliantly and briefly articulates the big challenge of a standing military, which, again, referring to our Constitution and our history, the founders were extremely suspicious, for good reason, of any standing military. And Eisenhower, it's readily available on YouTube and worth watching. It's resonated more and more because this is a fundamental challenge we face. I first became aware of Marshall when I was a small child, or pretty young. I got my first job when I was 13 years old, not because I was some kind of virtuous workaholic, but my dad, who was from the Depression and World War II generations, had a very, very powerful work ethic, and he greatly emphasized the importance of being independent and working for a living. And as part of your self-respect and self-worth, I was an office boy for an accountant who also had a small employment agency. He was a World War II veteran. He'd survived horrific combat on Bougainville in New Guinea rather early in the war. In the Army, he was one of these masses of young men who enlisted the day after Pearl Harbor from a Midwestern farm town. And there was a great contrast between the wholesome-looking young farm boy in the black-and-white photo in uniform that he had on his desk and the very badly damaged individual who had suffered severe burn, blast, and flash wounds from an artillery barrage. The Japanese that he and his unit were caught in. He was ferociously focused on the job, but I happened to be working there when General Marshall died, and he stopped to talk reverently about the chief of staff of the Army and how vital he was to success in the war, and it had a very profound impact on me and certainly helped spur an interest in history.
Right. You also mentioned in your column that the General Marshall resisted any temptation he might have felt and certainly resisted the overtures of all kinds of people who thought he should write his memoirs. And he was just far too discreet a gentleman to ever do that. And you cite a couple of other others who followed him in similar positions who have also showed a similar level of discretion that seems to be increasingly rare in this world in which we live.
And I talk about others who did not. Yeah, he believed, well, he was afraid of embarrassing people inadvertently, and he was afraid of inadvertently compromising national security. He also believed that serving the nation was just that, an opportunity for service, and you shouldn't profit financially from public service. It really was a different world, wasn't it? But that kind of character and integrity is extremely important all the time, and certainly more important than ever today. He didn't live in poverty. He came from some means, but there was a sense, it relates to the earlier point about business and politics in our country. There was a sense from that era of public service as being extremely important.
Right.
And
selflessness.
And it is.
Selflessness. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the word, selflessness.
Yeah. Speaking of President Eisenhower, I loved a quote that you had from him in another column, which talked about our intelligence community. And, of course, there has been a most tumultuous exchange between our intelligence
leaders. Yeah, the latest
leaders.
Reality TV program.
Right, and of course President Trump, and now the latest
Trump versus the spooks. Oh, right, it's terrific. Right. The ratings are wonderful, and everybody's sounding off, and it's...
Right. And of course now President Trump is saying that this controversy and strained relations is all a creation of the media.
Of course.
It wasn't actually there. But back to President Eisenhower.
Opens the door for the next installment.
Right. You quoted President Eisenhower in some comments about intelligence work that I thought was just great. President Eisenhower said, success, this is talking about intelligence work, in intelligence work, success cannot be advertised, failure cannot be explained. In the work of intelligence, heroes are undecorated and unsung, often even among their own fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you say that as to preface your comments about how much the leaders of our intelligence agencies seem to storm into the spotlight in terms of sharing information and their beliefs about the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, it is presumed by the Russians. And you think that was a really a poor lapse in judgment, serious lapse in judgment to be so public and in the spotlight. I think that's mm-hmm. at least part of your concern.
Yeah, there's a very useful statement that used to be read quite commonly in the in the press, in the media, when senior people were dealing with sensitive matters. The statement is no comment. You were not required to comment, and I'm very sorry it's faded from usage, especially among people who should know better, intelligence officials most of all, but also other senior people in the government. Ike was obsessed with intelligence and gathering information. We all should be concerned professionally and personally about the information around us, and given our flawed natures and emotional characters, you should be as dispassionate as possible in reviewing the circumstances, not in your family necessarily, although you should try to be aware of what's going on, I learned over many years, but in the workplace, collect as much useful information as possible. Everybody who works a job knows this at some level. But when the stakes are highest in national security, Eisenhower was successful as Supreme Allied Commander, later on as the first commander of NATO, earlier in his career as a principal staff aide to Douglas MacArthur, where he suffered enormously, and in the White House. He was always obsessed with good intelligence. And during World War II, FDR and Marshall not only elevated Eisenhower, but Roosevelt picked a very interesting, very colorful Irish Republican politician named William Donovan from New York, unsuccessful in seeking elected office. I think he ran for governor back in the 20s or 30s, partly because he was a solid Irishman. He was supposed to be a Democrat, not a Republican. He also didn't, his personality wasn't well suited, I think, for the glad-handing aspects of politics, but he turned out to be a brilliant, and I mean brilliant, head of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. During World War II, he developed the crucial relationship with British intelligence that continues to serve us well. That era, including at least two pretty good biographies of him, that history is well worth reading for anyone, but especially to understand the crucial importance of intelligence. Hmm. Operatives operating very effectively behind enemy lines in Europe and to some extent in Asia. An ability to pick men and women who are not necessarily good citizens, who were not necessarily people you'd want to spend a lot of time with in a non-war situation, but who were brilliant intelligence operatives. Donovan, who built the CIA, the Eisenhower quote is from the laying of the cornerstone, the groundbreaking for the building of the modern CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, in 1959.
Hmm.
There is still in Langley a very fine portrait of Donovan in uniform during the war that is quite an inspiring sight. That particular kind of leadership is particularly challenging and particularly important. And particularly stressful. And in hindsight, where everything is 20/20, Eisenhower's not only obsession with, but clarity in analyzing intelligence is one reason he was a truly great leader. The Bay of Pigs never would have happened. never would have happened and didn't.
Under Eisenhower.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I should mention that in that same column, you say something pretty interesting about Hillary Clinton and her campaign in saying that assuming that the Russians in fact were involved in this hacking and whether or not that was enough to actually tip the election. I mean, if that actually altered the results, you do go so far as to say that in a sense the real story here, what really brought them down was the content of those emails, which clearly you find really, really shocking.
Not just me. Well, I'm not that easily shocked in my old age,
right,
young man.
But you say the Clinton emails are filled with arrogance, entitlement, and gossip.
Yes. Yes, indeed. No, not shocked. I mean, stunned at their stupidity. We were talking about an earlier era, Joseph Kennedy, a successful architect of his son's political careers, as well as enormously successful businessman and rightly controversial fellow. My understanding is he emphasized from a very young age to the boys and throughout, don't put it in writing if it's at all sensitive, if it might come back to haunt you, if it might come back to hurt you, if it might embarrass you, if it might cost you politically, including embarrassing others. Don't put it in writing. I'm all for minutes of government meetings, and we always have minutes from our meetings at our Clausen Center because otherwise you trip over your own feet eventually. But I was stunned that these major big-time politicians would spend so much time at this and assume it's public information, especially with email. I tell our students, but also colleagues, that it is not private information. Assume it's public, because it may well become public.
Right.
Now, the vast majority of people are of no interest at all to the vast majority of the world, but it could happen. And with students especially, as we all know, the kind of stuff you post on Facebook, where it is public, could hurt you when you're looking for your first real job.
Right. So a costly lesson perhaps learned.
Podesta denigrating Catholics, sneering at a very large population, as well as a significant religion. It's just extraordinary.
Right. It was pretty foolish. And
they won the popular vote.
Right.
But had they, but Trump would not have won had a more conventional Democrat been running for the White House.
Right.
Well, would not have won the Electoral College.
Well, at any rate, we are under the administration of President Donald Trump, and of course, there's other news beyond that, including
yes, there is. Thank you.
Including something you wrote about that had kind of escaped my notice, namely the increasingly important role that the aforementioned Vladimir Putin is playing in the Middle East.
Yeah,
and in some respects, you see Russia stepping in to avoid that we are leaving. I mean, a void of our own leadership there. Just tell our listeners what you see happening there.
Putin, to his considerable credit, brokered a summit meeting from which the United States was excluded or simply ignored, as far as I can tell, involving major players in the region. The other major player being Turkey, but also Iran,
right,
has been directly involved, and Putin has developed good rapport with both of them. Syria has been a close ally of Russia and the predecessor Soviet Union since the 1960s. The Soviets developed relatively close alliances with just about all the Arab states after the 56 Suez Crisis in particular, and the relationship with Syria has proven to be very durable. They agreed on a ceasefire, ending the extraordinarily brutal and bloody Syrian civil war is in everybody's interest. And I believe a stable Syria, I don't think it's realistic to foresee in any kind of foreseeable future, in any near term, a democratic representative government in Syria or in most of the rest of that region. But I do think a stable Syria is very much in our interest. I do believe our interests and Russia's interests in this case and in a number of other cases in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and to some extent elsewhere in the world are congruent. We both have a strong interest in destroying the Islamic State and defeating various radical terrorist groups around the world. Russia and the former Soviet Union are far more vulnerable than we are to this kind of terrorism and have suffered on a continuing basis from this kind of extremism in ways that we, thank God, have not, despite the overblown rhetoric, including from the new administration, including since the inauguration, I'm sorry to say, we in fact have been very secure since 9/11. We shouldn't be complacent, but this fear of terrorism combined with basic domestic stability and security is, to me, it's troublesome, but it's also an important fact of life. It's troublesome that we're so fearful.
We're more fearful, you think, than we really need to be.
Of course. Fear itself really has taken over in a way, and you could see it in the last campaign, and you see it in lots of other dimensions of our collective life. It's amazing that Americans have to be so unhappy.
Right. You, we should give you a second to respond to President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from any participation in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-nation trade pact, which, of course, was hammered out over a long period of time during the Obama administration. But it was a real hot-button bone of contention during the presidential campaign. What would have been the value of the TPP? What is the benefit and or harm of us withdrawing from it?
I think it would have added probably some marginal benefit to the enormous prosperity that Americans overall, not just those at the top, but those of all, overall, all of us have enjoyed since World War II. It would not have added enormously compared to earlier rounds like the Kennedy round or the Tokyo round or especially the Iroquois round. Since World War II, there have been a whole series of multilateral trade agreements, starting with the relatively unknown Dillon round, a State Department official who became Kennedy's Treasury Secretary, State Department under Eisenhower, C. Douglas Dillon, spearheaded the first agreement to lower trade barriers. Fierce protectionism, high tariffs, and also other ways of keeping out foreign products in the 20s and 30s. There was a broad consensus during and following the war that it was in everybody's benefit if we could avoid that because that had contributed to the kind of nationalism and extremism and poverty that preceded World War II in Europe. From the Dillon round, the Kennedy round in the 60s, the Tokyo round in the 70s, and the Uruguay round in the 80s. Trade barriers were lowered. International trade was fostered. The steam ran out of this enormous global effort after the Uruguay round for two reasons. With the growth of free trade, the incentives for reducing barriers dissipated. These are dependent on tremendous, dedicated leadership. Clayton Yeider was a special trade representative under Reagan and then Secretary of Agriculture in the first Bush administration, also a Johnson distinguished visitor to Carthage. I got to know him when he was running the Chicago Mercantile Exchange before the Reagan administration in Chicago. One of the most extraordinarily energetic and intelligent people I've ever met. Clayton ran the Merc. Extremely demanding job in every dimension with all these commodities traders. He had worked a family farm on the weekends and just he drove through the Iroquois round. And these negotiators, including Mike Moscow, seemed to have this quality. We've not had leadership of that sort since the Iroquois round. President Obama was pro forma in favor of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was initiated by Japan and the U.S., left out China. We've had very, very dedicated people in the government during the Obama administration, in every administration. It was not driven from the top in the same way that these other agreements were, and it was dead for a long time. President Obama suddenly went on the rhetorical trail late last year to try to get it passed. It was long dead, in my view, by that time. The last significant agreement beyond the Uruguay round in the late 80s was the NAFTA agreement, which brilliant dealmaker Clinton, Bill Clinton, got through with a bipartisan vote. He had more Senate Republicans than Democrats for it. Protectionist trends have been developing in both parties. Politicians reflect, successful ones reflect broad public sentiment. There's a broad public movement in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere in the world away from free trade. And that's going to be a principal challenge for leaders going forward. The Brexit vote, withdrawing from the European Union in Britain, that's part of this very wide phenomenon, a kind of resurgence of nationalism.
Right.
Really important, really interesting. I think the benefits would have been marginal. It was, in many ways, an awful agreement in terms of how it was worked out and presented. Top civil servants in the Pacific, broad Pacific basin, and corporate types got together, hammered out this agreement that's understandable only to accountants and lawyers, and even then I've got concerns. Initially, members of Congress were not permitted to have copies. They could only go into a the whole thing was a public relations disaster and made to order, especially for Trump's populism.
Well, we will see just how some of these trends play out in the next years to come, and what the world looks like if some of these attitudes really take hold. In the meantime, I'm grateful for every opportunity we have to have you in the studios to share your perspective and commentary on all of these issues. Really appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you next month.
Well, thank you, Greg. The feeling's mutual.
Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. Tomorrow on the morning show, my guest is Andrew Sperling, who is director of federal legislation advocacy for NAMI National. NAMI, of course, is the National Alliance for Mental Illness. He's coming to Kenosha on Friday. And on Thursday, I speak with Captain James Hawkins. He is the commanding officer of the Great Lakes Naval Station in North Chicago. He happens to be a Kenosha native, and I'm excited to have him in the studios. And on Friday, I'll be speaking to the author of a fascinating book called Islamic Civilization in 30 Lives, The First 1,000 Years. The book, of really, really intriguing look at the history of Islam, framed in a series of 30 brief biographies of mostly men, but actually a few women as well, who were important figures in Islamic history. So that's the morning show for the balance of the week, and you find the program archived on our website, right on the front page of our website, wgtd.org.